This is a podcast from The Times.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 110. That's a lot of bugles. That's a lot of...
No one's denying that's a lot of bugles.
Did you ever think we'd do 110 of anything?
No. I guess that's the broader point.
For the week beginning Monday the 12th of April 2010, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in the spring-kissed, springtime city of London. And in New York City, it's about the only thing Britain has successfully exported in the last 10 years. Who needs a manufacturing sector when you can pack this guy across the ocean? He'll give you satire, not a flat tire, because he's not that dire. It's John Oliver!
Spring-kissed, Andy.
Sun-kissed. Did I say spring-kissed?
You said spring. You sound like Wordsworth.
Well, I've had a
not
long
in
night.
A good way.
I've had a long night, John. My little boy's been ill, and he was ill in an extremely vocal, prolonged manner.
I've never heard your tiredness manifest itself in kind of romantic poetry before, and I don't like it.
I was just waiting for the right moment, John. I was waiting for the right moment.
Well, hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. We are back after the Easter break. How was your Easter break, Andy? I mean, which story do you tell your children? Do you go with the Easter Bunny story, or do you tell them that the only reason they're getting chocolate eggs was because your people nailed a man to some wood a few years ago?
Well, I'd really major on the successful and extremely efficient workings of the legal system. That's
really?
Because obviously their mother's a lawyer, so they've got an interest in that. And you just think, you know, there he is, walks in on a donkey one day, and the whole thing's done 3 days later, isn't it? You know, up, down, up, down, bingo.
Just the efficient judicial system in action.
That's right. And, you know, and a very democratic one as well, isn't it? You know, the old mob justice.
Okay.
Gets you a very swift result, mob justice.
So it's option C that you tell them as you are plying them with chocolate eggs. Keep listening to my exposition of that story and you can have another chocolate egg.
I used to have a routine about chocolate eggs. It's a very inappropriate Easter snack. In the early days, my glorious stand-up career. Do you remember that?
Of course I remember it.
Seared into your
I remember the joke so much as the looks on the faces of the people who were listening to it. A mix between confusion, anger, disbelief, back to anger.
And those were just the Catholics.
Boom!
Actually, I've got a funny story this week, John. For the first time in his young life, my 15-month-old son was thrown out of a venue for being underage. I took my two kids to a puppet theatre in North London, and it was for a production of Goldilocks, aimed at the 3 to 7 age group, and they wouldn't let us in because my boy was under the age of 3, therefore too young.
Have you not got him a fake ID yet?
Well, if only I could have just drawn a little moustache on his face. But so I know you mentioned a few bugles ago about you now have an enemy. Can't remember who was your nemesis that you were.
Octopuses,
Andy. That's it.
I called them out.
You called out the octopuses. Well, I now have a blood feud that will never be resolved with a small puppet theatre in North London with a ludicrous admissions policy.
Okay, add that to the list, Andy.
It's
a two-person list now. Puppet theatres and octopuses.
Who says we don't attack the big targets? Happened to Matilda in Melbourne too. She was chucked out of a nightclub where the minimum age was 21, and she fell under that by 20 years and 9 months. Well, I did have fake ID for her, but didn't cut it. She just wanted to dance, John. Is that wrong? Should we stop from doing that? So, week beginning Monday, the 12th of April, 2010, that's 404 years to the day, John, since Great Britain adopted the Union flag, an amalgamative wodging of the English and Scottish flags. In the years preceding, there had been serious consideration given to a flag incorporating a silhouette of both the English Queen Elizabeth's Norks and the Scottish King James's Nadgers, but this was rejected as being, quote, the kind of thing the Spanish might do. So it didn't happen. And it wasn't, of course, just the flag that was amalgamated back in 1606. For a while, the nation had imposed on it a single standard British hat. It was a cross between the English stovepipe and the Scottish tam o' shanter. And the government also brought in a tranche of all British swear words that we still use to this day, mixing, for example, the Scottish insult cullcase with the English priant and the English farglet with a northern cladach and the Scottish shing with England's flothead. So, we've got all our swear words that we use today. It's been a long week. Also, 65 years since Franklin D. Roosevelt said to his pals, "Hey, fellas, what does the D in my name stand for?" And they replied, "Is it still Delano?" And Roosevelt quit back, "No, it's dead." By which I mean, I am dead. And it's also 49 years to the second since the first human spaceflight, John, when Yuri Gagarin was sent by the Soviets to see if he could find the dog they'd lost up there. He didn't find it, but he did find the missing 1930s aviatrix Amelia Earhart slapping her dashboard, screaming, "Go down, you stupid f-!"
Top story this week, the final countdown to nearly 50% of eligible UK voters not bothering to put some paper in a box.
Yeah, they said it would never happen, John. They said it was an impossible dream. They said no one would have the balls to make it happen. But it's on, John. It is on! It's general election time. Actually, I got a bit of that wrong. They said it would definitely happen. They said it was a procedural inevitability. And they said no one would have the policies to make it interesting. But it is still on. It's on. Democracy
it's
lives.
It's on like Donkey Kong. It might not have received much coverage over here in the US, Andy, but indeed Britain has announced the date of its next election, and it is to be, wait for it, May the 6th. So put it in your diaries, spray paint it onto your fridge, tattoo it onto your children's foreheads, and everyone, and I do mean everyone, everyone in the world, take the day off work May the 6th. Make sure you spend the entire 24 hours sitting in front of your television, flipping the channels and wondering why there seems to be no coverage of the UK election where you are.
It's interesting you should say that, because I was on a school trip to Greece in 1992 on the day of the general election then. we were all gathered around. It was waiting for the results to come late at night. But the only international TV channel in this Greek hotel was CNN.
Right.
And we were waiting for the result of the general election that had been built up as being a hugely significant defining moment in the history of modern Britain. Mm-hmm. Choice between, you know, still properly left-wing Labour and the continuation of the legacy of Thatcher. And it was mentioned in about a 30-second final score, basically, after a 10-minute report about a farmer from Arkansas who'd lost a hand in a combine harvest.
But why hasn't this been a bigger news story around the world this week, Andy? Well, I think it's because the UK are clearly doing a few things wrong. One, Britain is simply not as relevant as it used to be. If it could fix that and once again become a dominant imperial superpower, that would go a long way to piquing people's interest. Two, where's the razzmatazz? Here in the US, they automatically know when the next election is going to be. There's no element of surprise. So the UK has a huge advantage there with the opportunity to announce it with some spectacle, and they blow it every time. Where was the motorcycle pyramid jumping through a hoop of fire while holding a horticultural arrangement spelling out May the 6th in tulips? Where was it? Instead, it was once again a group of men in charcoal suits reading out a press release. Not, and I repeat, not from the top of a motorcycle pyramid. Come on! Wow me! Also, number three, the election campaign is just not long enough in the UK. 4 weeks? What? 4 weeks? What can you do in 4 weeks, Andy? The election here in America took a year and a half last time. It's like John Adams said, if it doesn't take over 6 months, it's probably not worth doing.
He was talking about human pregnancy at that point.
Doesn't matter. And he was biologically correct at that time.
Well, I don't think everyone is talking about it here, John, other than on the TV news channels where they're obviously massively excited by it. One of the major features of this election campaign, apart from the cynical use of leaders' spouses and the squawkingly infantile poster campaigns, is this slightly more Americanised coverage, actually. They seem to follow all the leaders around the whole time and interview them about every 30 seconds. In effect, the three-party leaders are just on a permanent Twitter feed, a verbal Twitter feed. And I think there is a large chance that most Britain will emigrate on May the 5th just to avoid the end of it. Alistair Darling, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was yesterday rebutting Conservative financial figures and said these very clever words: what you can't do is spend money you don't know you've got. Which, a man basically holding the purse strings of a government who spent a lot of money that it did know it didn't have. That's an interesting sideways step. If you don't know you've got it, you shouldn't spend it. But if you know you don't have it, spend away. That's economics, John. That's why you and me can't do it. We don't have that level of sideways thought.
David Cameron, the Conservative candidate, is, as part of their manifesto, proposing voluntary national citizen service for all 16-year-olds, where they join a 2-month residential scheme featuring outdoor activities and community work. He said, "Show me a gang taking drugs, and I'll show you a group of people who have nothing to look forward to." Now, hold on. I mean, that's not strictly true, Andy. I believe they're very much looking forward, for instance, to the next time they take drugs. That's the ideal thing on their horizon. And also, not that this scheme doesn't have its merits in principle, but I would question the viability of appealing to a gang taking drugs with a 2-month scheme of outdoor activities and community work.
I don't know, yeah, probably just have the, it's not the same instant adrenaline rush, is it?
No, it's a longer high. A more sustained high.
Just that more ultimately satisfying.
An interesting fact regarding the UK elections, and one that probably provides a great insight into the British electorate psyche, is that our elections are always held on a Thursday. Now, this is just a convention rather than a full legal stipulation. The original reason for it being that people were not paid until Fridays, so holding polls on Thursdays ensured that they were not too drunk to vote. We might want to vote, Andy, but such is our predilection for self-annihilation that we need to be protected from our own bad decisions by scheduling the election on the one day a week we are least likely to be unconscious. Such is our drinking problem. We need that decision taken out of our hands. And apparently the Electoral Commission has recommended trials of weekend voting as a way of improving turnout. But again, they will just have to be trials, Andy, and I fear that those trials may reveal results of a lot of people vomiting, urinating and falling asleep in voting booths.
Does that count as a spoiled ballot paper?
Oh, you know it does.
If you've chundered on it. So that's the ultimate protest vote. Just a ballot paper wrapped up containing a small morsel of sick. So for our non-British-based Bugle listeners who might not know too much about them, we are going to be doing a week-by-week series of profiles on the leaders in this election campaign, starting this week with the front-runner, David Cameron of the Conservatives, or Dave Cameron, as he insists on being called, a 43-year-old career politician with a wealth of experience in, for example, well, I'm sure it'll be fine. His big idea that he thought of recently is this: the big society. They've been talking about the big society, John. This is their
what does
thing
that mean, Andy?
Well,
because that's a slightly catchy phrase. What does that actually mean? Two words together.
Well, I mean, I guess it means that there's a society, and they want to make it big.
Okay, that's what I thought it meant. Yeah. Okay, carry on.
Okay, but it's basically an emphasis on community schemes and volunteer work. To basically pick up the slack when the state just can't be asked to do something.
Yeah.
And it's something of a turnaround for the Tories, of course, whose prominent 1980s nation-splitting leader, Margaret Thatcher, as the French called her, famously said there was no such thing as society. And now Cameron is talking about big society. So it's quite a turnaround, although to be fair to Thatcher, she'd got her words mixed up and meant to say there's no such thing as a unicorn. And I would advise all buglers to steer well clear of Thatcher's children's literature. It is, at best, dry. So, Cameron's other main policy is having a nice wife. But yet again, this just shows the lack of choice in this election campaign, John, because Gordon Brown's wife, she also seems nice. Mm-hmm. And the Liberal Democrat leader, Nick Clegg, his wife, she seems nice too. So
right.
Where's the choice?
You know? They're all fighting over the middle ground.
That's
there.
Right. What about the disenfranchised silent majority who like their politicians to marry total bitches? Who's catering for them, John? I think this actually, I think this might be another reason why people are drifting towards the BNP. Now, I don't know what Nick Griffin's wife is like, but I do know what Nick Griffin is like, and I'm prepared to go with my hunch that Mrs. Griffin isn't with him for his looks. So, as in America now, celebrity endorsements becoming more and more important in British politics, and the Conservatives yesterday unveiled actor Michael Caine as their supporter.
What?
Yeah, Michael Caine is a Tory, John.
No!
Yep.
Michael Caine is voting Conservative.
Yep. How are the mighty swung slightly to the right?
Ugh.
Will that swing it, though, John? Will Michael Caine decide this election? Will anyone be sitting at home on May the 6th thinking, I can't decide how to vote, the entire future of my country is at stake? Well, it's obviously not. It's really just a minor difference in how the accounts are done. But let's spice things up a bit. The survival of Britain is on the line. I can't bring myself to vote for a government that has largely wasted a vast democratic mandate over 13 increasingly irritating years, nor for an opposition that seems to fly with the wind and hasn't entirely left behind its legacy of division, nor for the third party whose name I can't even remember and who believe in bits and bobs of stuff. How to choose? Guide me, O Lord. Hang on, is that Michael Caine? I'm voting for them! Yeah, is that how democracy works?
It kind of is. You know, he means a lot to people. Personally, I've, for the last 20 years of my life, worn an ankle bracelet that has a WWMCD on it. You know, he's a guiding light. This gives me pause for thought.
Would you now vote, you know?
Well, I mean, now I'll swim over, no, Andy, to get there in time.
You know, because, you know, fellow film star, of course. You know, maybe he's the role model that your lagging democracy is crying out for. So for the next few weeks, Buglers, until the election is finally done and mercifully dusted, we will have an election feature section every week with all the latest must-have news and gossip from the election campaign, by which I mean really reporting on whether Britain can summon itself enough enthusiasm to give a quarter of a shit.
It won't be so much must-have news as can-have and will-have news, Andy. Yeah. But still.
We'll have and then we'll probably try to forget.
Yeah. Nuke news now! And President Obama made promises last year, Andy, to try and help wean America and the world off nuclear weapons. And now that's obviously not going to be easy. The truth is that nuclear weapons are far too addictive ever to be completely free of. They're like heroin. You know, a heroin addict is never not a heroin addict. The best case scenario is that they become a heroin addict who doesn't take heroin anymore, or that they find fame with a band called the Stooges. But this last week, Obama made a small step forward and signed a new nuclear pact with Russia. The pact commits both nations to slash the number of strategic nuclear warheads by one-third and more than half the number of missiles, submarines and bombers that carry them. Now, this might seem to be suddenly happening all too quickly, but don't worry, Andy. This reduction still leaves both countries with enough firepower to ensure mutual destruction several times over. So that's a huge relief. I personally wouldn't be able to sleep at night if we were going to go down to just mutual destruction. I think it really has to be multiple mutual destruction to have any hope of working as a deterrent. But it's true that the main impact of this treaty is not so much what it does as what it symbolises. It's a big step for the US and Russia to decide to work together rather than both continue to act like dicks. And that essentially was the choice available to them. It's not really much more complicated than that. In fact, I believe that was on the second page of the treaty. We'll both try not to act like dicks. Also, on this Tuesday, Obama unveiled his new nuclear posture review, which openly reduces the circumstances under which the US would consider using nuclear weapons. It states that the United States will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states that are party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and in compliance with their nuclear non-proliferation obligations. Now, that doesn't seem particularly dramatic, especially when you consider that the review also
reserves the right for the US to use nuclear weapons if one of the member states uses a chemical attack against them. So again, a development which is more meaningful symbolically than practically, but that hasn't stopped the response by some conservatives in America from being like a broken fertilizer machine, loud and completely full of shit. Sarah Palin said that the new policy was like a kid asking for a punch in the face. Unfortunately, forgetting the fact that it isn't like that at all. And the next best thing to never thinking that analogy would be never saying it out loud.
I guess she's right in a way, John, but she just hasn't finished the analogy. I guess it's like a kid asking for a punch in the face whilst that kid is armed with an automatic machine gun.
Well, she went on to say, it's like getting out there on a playground, a bunch of kids, getting ready to fight, and one of them says, go ahead, punch me in the face, I'm not going to retaliate, do what you want to with me. Whereas, in fact, what it's actually like is a kid going into a playground and saying, who likes being hit in the face? Exactly, no one. So let's all agree not to hit each other in the face. Anyone, for instance, who promises not to hit me in the face, I promise I will not hit them in the face. But if they do then hit me in the face, I will definitely hit them in the face back. And let's not focus on that part. Let's focus on the everyone not getting punched in the face bit instead. Whereas Sarah Palin, for instance, is like a kid going into that playground during the discussion and saying, hey, I'm pretty sure he's asking us all to hit him in the face, unless I'm either an idiot or willfully misinterpreting what he's saying for my own ends. But I'm really pretty sure he wants us to hit him in the face.
Bugle feature section now, and food. We all need it, John. Without it, we'd all be pretty tired and angry.
Yeah. Oh, really? Tired and angry rather than dead. It's interesting that was the way your mind went there. We'd be cranky without food. Missing a meal. Never liked to do that.
And the extent to which we as a species are dependent on food is proved by the fact that even Jesus ate food.
Yeah.
And it turns out that over the years, he's been eating more and more food in paintings of the Last Supper. Apparently, over the years, in the representations of the Last Supper, the portions that Jesus and his squad, what are they called?
Posse?
Posse. Jesus. The Blazing Squad, or was that someone else?
It wasn't that. Right. Well, it definitely wasn't Hell's Angels.
Anyway. Their meals have got bigger and bigger over the years as the size of meals elsewhere has got bigger. In fact, a recent painting by the prominent American artist Chuck McCalliock recently showed Jesus eating a quadruple-decker burger at the Last Supper. So maybe there's some truth in this. And he also, he could do magic with food. Jesus famously fed the 5,000 or so, sneakily could turn a quarter pounder into a half pounder. Often while no one was looking. He didn't always draw attention to his miracles.
That was a selfish miracle.
Yeah.
Just for himself. These researchers compared the size of food in 52 of the most famous portrayals of the Last Supper and found that the size of the main dish grew 69%, the size of the plate 66%, and the bread 23%. And at that rate, Andy, Jesus would have died of diabetes long before he died of crucifixion, screaming at the heavens, "Forgive them, Father, they know not how to use low-fat cream in their sauces." Also, let's cut the artist a little slack here for wanting to give Jesus a heftier portion. This was his last meal, for f*** sake. Why stop there? Throw in a dessert for the lad, too. Maybe some barbecue pulled pork. Perhaps an artisan cheese board and coffee. Sure, it's not good for his arteries, but let's remember, he's about to die soon anyway.
I'm not sure he was much of a pork eater, as I recall.
But that's what I mean. It doesn't matter. It's his last meal, Andy.
Right.
Pulled pork is delicious.
Yeah. So maybe that did happen. Maybe that was the start of
Christianity. How's his day going to get worse?
It's interesting, actually, the feeding the 5,000 story. It's fascinating. There's a recently discovered and as yet unpublished gospel according to Alvin that was dug up in an archaeological dig in Egypt.
Uh-huh. And to Alvin?
Yeah.
Not the chipmunk?
No, just Alvin.
Oh, okay, right.
He was one of the lesser disciples.
I thought it was a squeakier.
He was a standby disciple. He was like a temp. He used to come in when one of the other ones went on holiday.
Off the bench, or if one of them pulls a hamstring.
That's right. And he offers a radical new version of one of Jesus H. Christ's most famous miracles. Of course, the story goes that Jesus was then in his late 20s or early 30s. He'd just finished a particularly long and involved new parable in front of a sold-out 5,000-strong audience at an outdoor festival gig. When he noticed that his crowd was looking quite tired and hungry, and as the gospel relates, and the audience was bored, and Salif, who was from Jericho, did heckle Jesus and said unto him, "Oi, Jesus, get off, that was self-indulgent rubbish, you've lost your edge." But Jesus refrained from telling Salif that he did not come down to where he worked and tell him how to clean toilets, for he was merciful and believed his new parable to be artistically valid. That's Alvin chapter 14, verse 12. So, therefore, Jesus had to pull something out of the bag, and in lieu of his usual dead mouse, live mouse encore, he promised to give the crowd 5 loaves of sliced white and 2 whole cod from his dressing room. That was his contractual rider at all of his major shows by this stage of his career. It's pretty similar to what you get these days as well, isn't it, John?
It's not too dissimilar, no. Yeah.
So, but he then buttered 4 of the loaves, filleted and mashed the fish, and shaped it into thin rectangles, which he then covered with breadcrumbs from the 5th loaf. So after a quick whiz in the frying pan, Jesus then lent a fish finger sandwich to each of his 12 disciples, even Thomas, who was vegan, and Andrew, who'd hated the smell of fish ever since being shoved into an aquarium on a school trip. The self-proclaimed Son of God then told the apostles to pay him back whenever they could. He hopped on his magic donkey, winked at the crowd, and skedaddled. Now, the disciples, being good Christian men, of course, they felt guilty about being the only ones with food in an increasingly bemused, ravenous and restless congregation. Therefore, each disciple lent his fish finger sandwich to a member of the audience, and inspired by this example, those spectators then passed their food on to the people sitting next to them, who in turn lent it to the people sitting next to them, and so on, until eventually 12 people sat at the back row were left clutching somewhat soggy and misshapen fish finger sandwiches, while each of the remaining 4,988 people in the capacity crowd was owed 1 fish finger sandwich. And in this way, although Jesus didn't actually technically feed the 5,000, he did enable them all to go home knowing that they were 1 fish finger sandwich in credit, which they could call in whenever they felt like a snack. And thus Jesus invented the principles of capitalist finance. So,
well, Andy, it's interesting side note to these jokes about Jesus that we, but predominantly you, have been doing here. is that, as I mentioned to you beforehand, the guy who has been helping Paul out here building the new studio, he's a Honduran preacher.
Right.
He's here in New York to study the Bible, doing some construction work on the side. And he pointed out to Paul that Jesus is in the walls here.
Right.
So Jesus is just behind those 2 pieces of drywall over there, Andy, and I guess he's been listening in on everything you just said. I thought I could hear a pounding on the wall, and it must be him. That scared the life out of me. Oh, God, I've never been more relieved to see Paul through the window looking at a microphone. If that had been empty then, I think I'd have killed myself. Oh, God.
His wrath hath cometh.
Oh, boy. God, Jesus. Just quick to anger, isn't he?
Check Paul's hands, John. Check those. Oh, I'm glad you like my feeding the 5,000 story. It was a... I've got a bit waylaid with my kid this week, being being ill, cut into my writing time. That was a little excerpt from my best-selling book.
Best-selling by whose standards, Andy?
I don't know, but I got an email from a prominent online book retailer this week offering me my own book. It's still out there, Buglers, if you've not got your copy yet. Your emails now, and, well, the stories of classic bird flips have continued to fly in. This one comes from Dan Chambers on the subject Bryan Adams marathon bird flip. You already have our attention. And yep. It says, "Hi, John and Andy. Back in the 1990s, a friend of mine won 2 tickets to see strepsil-shunning, rumple-faced, chart-hogging Canadian plonker Bryan Adams in concert.
Wow.
Despite the fact that he hated Bryan Adams with a majestic, towering intensity, he kept the tickets and went alone to the gig because it allowed him to spend the entire 2 hours of the concert standing in the front row with one arm at full stretch, flipping the bird, following Adams wherever he went on stage like an unerring, laser-guided spiked howitzer."
Beautifully put.
Beautifully put. A beautiful story, beautifully told.
The single-digit salute, proudly standing defiantly amongst a sea of Adams enablers.
But I bet that would be the only person he remembers from that gig, Brian Adams.
Yeah, that's true.
He'll have had 40,000 screaming girls there. He'll just remember the bird.
We have a great email here from Nick.
Oh, hang on. Let me interrupt you. I forgot the PS.
Oh, yeah?
From Dan Chambers on that email. F*** you, Chris.
Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Great email here from Nick Dietz, who says, Dear John and Andy, in order of estimated pogo sticking ability, that's definitely true. I could wipe the floor with you on a pogo, Andy.
What do you mean? I did Swan Lake on a pogo stick at school.
That was a long time ago, Andy. Your skills are dusty, old man. After hearing the American mention the Bugle's new hotline in episode 109, I immediately grabbed the phone and dialed 1-800-BRIT-FUN. However, instead of the Bugle's trademark brand of humour, or humour, as you Brits would say, I was treated to a recording of either Andy or John, whichever of you does the less realistic American whore impression, informing me that I could talk to hot, horny girls who will do anything I want for just 99 cents a minute. The ensuing telephone episode of the Bugle was rather mediocre, particularly for $38.95. Cheers, Nick. P.S. I'm still having trouble tracking down Tom in Australia, but I'm pretty sure he's either the associate director of the Sydney Theatre Company or the former captain of the North Sydney Bears rugby team. Oh, you're warm on one of those. There's there's an email here directly to Chris from Alani, who says, Dear Chris, I'm sure you're actually a very nice man, but ever since Bush left office, I've had the insatiable itch to mindlessly yet passionately protest something. You, sir, have scratched that itch, and I thank you. Now, I think this is what the Chris kickback is about, and I think he's providing a very useful scapegoat for people in these difficult times. Just a one-man figure of abstract hate. You mean you don't need to back that up? You just need to channel all your frustrations into him.
To think my mum said I'd never come to anything.
There you go. It's a viable, valuable public service that you're providing, Chris.
I welcome it. I welcome the service I provide. Yeah.
People can blame you for anything this way and no one gets hurt apart from your feelings.
You're like a psychological punch bag.
Yeah.
For the world.
Yeah. Bring it on. I won't be broken.
Whoa, that's defiant, Chris. I love it. In fact, you know what that reminds me of? Jesus Christ on the cross. Hold on, he's tapping again. He said it's nothing like it, it's just a producer. And that those nails really hurt. All right, J-Dog. Calm it.
Bugle Sport now, and well, only one story in sports this week, John, although there are quite a lot of other stories, but Tiger Woods.
Oh, he's back, Andy.
Back as we record. He's finished his first round yesterday, 4 under par, his best ever first round at the Masters. And I think there was a real missed opportunity, John, when he had his interview after the first round in a very smart, I don't know if it was in the butler cabin or not, but he's in a very smart room, very sitting down with an interviewer, and I thought the interviewer really missed the chance of a lifetime, John, to say, so, Tiger, it's your best ever first round at the Masters, a really extraordinary return to top-level golf after 5 months out. You must be absolutely delighted. But tell me, did you see any sweet tail on your way around? Now, how about that blonde at the 10th, just standing by the green? I mean, hot diggity, Tiger, hot diggity! Nothing?
Tiger Woods is indeed back, Andy, doing what he is second best at, golf. We all know what he's best at. That doesn't need saying. One of the most interesting things in the lead-up to it was his new advert with Nike, which featured his sad face on a camera close-up with the voice of his dead father saying, I want to know what your thinking was. I want to find out what your feelings are. And did you learn anything? I mean, it's impressive, Andy. I think we all now have a surprising answer to the question, can Tiger Woods stoop any lower? The other main sport news of the week, Andy, is that Lionel Messi is f***ing amazing at football. Now, this isn't a new thing. He's long been f***ing amazing at football. But this week he was extra specially f***ing amazing. He scored 4 goals against Arsenal. He probably should have scored 20 against. So that would have been the fair return for his industry. He is absolutely, if you don't like football, You know, that's your right, even though you are wrong about that. But I challenge you to watch Messi play and not fall in love with the game. It's not illustrative of the broader game, but he is absolutely amazing. And I think he's been embodied in the fact that there is now a chocolate Messi, a Spanish chocolatier in a pastry shop in Spain is displaying a life-size sculpture of Messi made entirely of chocolate. It's £254. And it weighs 72% more than Lionel Messi. And it sounds ridiculous, and yet when you think about it, he deserves it, Andy. He deserves to be immortalised in chocolate. There should be a terracotta army of Messi in chocolate somewhere. The guy's amazing.
Oh, charity contribution update news now, and my daughter has now raised £3,258.07.
That's phenomenal.
Thank you, Buglers, all 614 of you.
I'm guessing, Andy, that Matilda is the highest fundraising child at that nursery school.
I think so. I haven't checked for sure yet, but she's done very well. She personally thanks every single one of you, so thank you, Buglers. You can still contribute if you've forgotten to do so far. We're still short of the $1 billion target, and I don't want her to have to live with that stain of failure from such an early age, so... Keep your 10p's flooding in. So that's it, Buglers. Do keep your emails flooding into thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. And particularly if you've got any questions about the British election that you want me, as a political expert of no standing, to answer, then do send them in. In the meantime, have the best week of your lives. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.